8:50 a.m.
Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome everyone, welcome to the show today. You know, after years of hard work and sometimes at significant personal sacrifice, many people reach a place in their careers that others find enviable. But what happens when the door to that career is slammed shut? Or, as in my case, they find that the ladder they chose to climb is now leaning against the wrong wall. Well, after 20 years in television, Darren Kagan unwittingly found herself at the end of a great gig, facing, as she said in her own words, the big blank slate of her life. She had no idea what to do or in which direction to head, but she did know she wanted to make a difference. Former CNN anchorwoman Darren Kagan is joining me today to share her personal journey, as well as some wonderfully inspiring true stories of ordinary people who dared to dream they could make a difference. I'd like to welcome Darren Kagan to the show today. Welcome.
It's great to be with you.
And I should say that you are the founder of DarrenKagan.com and the author of What's Possible, 50 True Stories of People Who Dared to Dream They Could Make a Difference. And we'll definitely be going into that later in the show.
Super.
But Darren, your journey in itself was very inspiring to me when I read it at the beginning of the book. So I'd like to focus on that to start with. Had you always wanted to be a reporter? I guess that's the first question I want to start with.
Let's go way, way back. I actually grew up in Southern California, and my first inspiration was I wanted a job that was different every day and that I didn't work in an office. And I was watching Connie Chung as a local anchorwoman one day. I was in high school. I thought, well, there's a job like that, and that's kind of, you know, I think a lot of people go through a lot of different things they want to be, and just pretty much the first thing I thought of stuck, and yeah, so I knew from the time I went away to college that I wanted to go into television news.
Yeah. No, it didn't come easy. I mean, I don't think that kind of work does to anybody because it's very competitive for one. But you started in Phoenix, is that correct?
I actually started in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
I graduated Stanford, and I got in my car, and I drove to all the small markets in California and Oregon. And the deal was the first place I got a job, that's where I was going to live. And I lucked out, and it was Santa Barbara, which is one of the most beautiful places in the world and not such a bad place to pay your dues.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah, that's a good place. And I was there a couple of years, and then that station was sold, and I was laid off. And I spent my 25th birthday in the unemployment line and did what every responsible young American does, picked up and moved home with mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
And then got in my car again and went to the next size market, and that's when I ended up in Phoenix. So Phoenix was actually my second job.
Mm. I think people don't realize with so many jobs, you really do have to pick up and move where the work is, right?
Yeah, especially in the news business. I mean, there's different ways, and especially, I mean, now with the different outlets, it might be a little bit different for young people, but really the traditional way is you start in a small market, just to get, when you talk about markets, so New York is the largest in the U.S., L.A. is number two, Seattle would be probably our top 10 or top 15 market. And so I started in market 113, and then Phoenix was market 19. So you start small, and then you go medium, and you have to work your way up to get the different kind of opportunity.
Right, and I remember reading somewhere in your book, you said that if you have brunette hair, you're a reporter. If you have blonde hair, you're an anchor.
Oh.
And you said, take a look at my picture. I have brunette hair.
At that particular station in Phoenix where I worked, yeah, the blondes were the anchors, and I was the one token brunette. In fact, I replaced, if people watch ABC News now, they know Elizabeth Vargas. She had been the brunette there before me. Elizabeth was leaving, so they had room for a brunette, and you were allowed to report. And they made me sign a 5-year contract, which, of course, in your 20s feels like a lifetime contract.
Mm-hmm.
And, every time there would be an opportunity to anchor, which is kind of more of a high-status thing in local news, I would go into that news director's office, and I'd say, well, can I have a chance? And he would say, you know, Darren, in television, there's just this it, and some people have it, some people don't, and clearly you don't. So if you work really hard one day, you'll be a good reporter in Phoenix, but why would you dream of being anything else?
Huh.
That's kind of a buzzkill.
And obviously you didn't let that stop you.
I was in this interesting situation. I couldn't say, well, forget you, I'll go work for somebody else because I was under the 5-year contract.
Sure.
But we did this dance of, oh, I know, I'll show him I'll be an even better reporter and then he'll give me my chance.
Mm.
And so I'd go out, and it ended up being a challenge that served me quite well because I ended up being his top reporter, but never did get a chance to anchor at that station. But really, at that time in my life, I can look back now and realize those were the skills I was meant to be learning, mm-hmm. how to be a really good reporter, not how to be an anchor in the local market.
Right. And that's good, solid skills that set you up for your dream job, ultimately. But
mm-hmm.
So you were out there reporting on what? What kind of stories did you cover?
When I was in Phoenix, I was the general assignment reporter. So, you know, the typical... it's a bleed that leads, you know. But also, it turns out that this was a very, very good station. They had what you would say all the toys. They had the satellite truck and they had the helicopter. And they really saw their world as beyond Phoenix. So in terms of being a reporter, it was a tremendous opportunity. I mean, I went all over the West, covered the riots in L.A. And if there was a big trial in L.A., they would send me over there. Got to see every corner of Arizona. Really learned how to tell a story, which... serves me to this day.
Mm.
So anything from a murder to a riot to that's really where I developed my interest in sports. And so I did a lot of sports reporting there too.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you developed this interest for sports. I think some of that came from the influence of your father, Stu, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, well, my dad was a big sports fan and I had a brother who's a year older. So that's kind of what we did. We did sports growing up. We participated in sports. We went to lots of sporting events. So I grew up around it, and I liked it, and as I was there in Phoenix, I started noticing that, you know, maybe I shouldn't be trying to be a local news anchor. What I really want to go do is go do sports. So I walked into that same boss's office and said, well, forget the anchor thing. What do I want to do sports? And he looked at me, and he said, women don't do sports. Men won't watch women doing sports, and that's a silly dream. And then that was actually a very important turning point for me because I knew he was wrong. I knew he might be right about me not having it and not making it in television, but this was the time when Robin Roberts was coming up at ESPN and Hannah Storm was already on CNN Sports, and I could see he was missing a trend and that actually this was, if you could really learn your stuff and do it right, that this was a huge opportunity for women in sports. And so I really just had to, get my act together, learn how to be a sportscaster, and get out of there.
Mm.
And ultimately, that's what happened.
Well, this was an interesting twist in your story because this, again, shows your determination to do what you want to do, not take no for an answer, and plow through that rejection. How did you get that first opportunity to do sports reporting?
Well, so I was still in Phoenix, and the first thing I started doing was looking for sports stories that were happening around town that the regular sports guys didn't want to go do. They'd gotten a little too lazy. So I did that on my own time. And then the station started a weekend morning newscast, which is pretty standard now with local affiliates around the country, but it was kind of a new thing in the mid-90s. And so I went into this news director and I said, you know that new show on the weekend mornings? I want to be the sportscaster for that. And he said, well, that show doesn't have a sportscaster job. I said, I know. I made it up myself, and I gave it to myself, and there's no competition. It's perfect.
And I'm going to do it for free, right?
Exactly. Well, at that point, he's, like, shaking his head, because in the news business, if you work weekends, then you get Monday, Tuesday off. And
mm-hmm.
now I'm his top reporter, because I work so hard at that. He's like, no, I'm not. I have no interest in giving you Monday, Tuesday off so that you can do a sport, do sports on the weekends. And I said, well, what if I do it on my own time?
Mm.
And he said, you can work 7 days a week? And I said, we'll do it for a month. And if you think I'm really bad at it, or I hate it, or I'm doing bad at my regular job, you can pull me off of it. And so what's he going to say when you go to your boss and you tell him you're doing something for free?
Mm-hmm.
So we made the deal that I would do it for a month. And at this point, I really knew this man. And I knew, you know what, he's not waking up on the weekend mornings and watching this show, so I can do this for as long as I need to. And so I did it for a year and a half, where I worked 7 days a week.
Wow.
And even ultimately, that still wasn't enough to get me a job. I was working 7 days a week. I was sending out tapes. I was sending out news tapes, sending out sports tapes, all these things. And nothing was happening. No one was telling me why I wasn't getting hired. And a friend, a blonde anchor at the station, said, why don't you talk to my agent? She works with women in sports. And I said, oh, that would be great. And she goes, but she's really blunt. Like, she's going to. And I thought, this was one of those bottom times in my life. You know, the job wasn't happening. The boyfriend had dumped me. You know, one of those, why do you get out of bed in the morning?
Right.
I'm like, there is nothing this lady can say to me that's going to hurt my feelings. And so I sent her a tape, and she called me back. She goes, you know, she also warned me that she was blunt. And she said, you know, you're really good. You just need to update your look. And I said, excuse me? And she said, you just need to update your look. Cut your hair, and you'll be shocked how fast you go. And I said, lady, I went to Stanford. I've won Emmy Awards. I'm working 7 days a week, and you're telling me it's a haircut?
Isn't that amazing?
And I should say, at this time, I actually have kind of naturally curly hair, and my hair was down below my shoulders and think kind of post-80s mullet. Not a beautiful sight. Somebody probably should have told me this a long time ago. But
I'm sure it wasn't that bad.
hung up the phone. I thought, okay, what the heck? I hung up the phone. I went to the local salon. I cut it off short. I mean, and short, like cute, like Halle Berry was wearing it.
Uh-huh.
And 2 weeks later, CNN hired me as a sports anchor. The two things that that boss told me I would never do, sports and anchor.
Well, see, they saw talent, and they saw the it factor.
They saw it, yes. In fact, during that interview, when they flew me to Atlanta, the man who ultimately hired me, who now is actually in charge of all of CNN, he said, well, you know why you're here, don't you? I was like, you know, I was so beyond, I couldn't figure out why I was there. He said, well, you know, Darren, in television, there's just this it, and some people have it and some people don't, and clearly you do. And but surely you've heard that many times before. I said, well, one version of that anyway. And they hired me, and I picked up and moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and never looked back.
Well, excellent. And I've seen you on CNN, and I see the it factor there,
oh, well,
too.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you get to CNN, and you've got this great job, the job that you wanted. And I think you were there like 8 years doing sports before you got into hard news. Is that correct?
No, actually, I did sports for 3 years.
Okay.
And the interesting twist there was that they hired a new president, Rick Kaplan, who is now running Katie Couric's show at CBS. But Rick was the president of CNN, and he called me in and he said, you know, I really like you doing the sports thing, but have you ever thought about doing news? And I said, well, yeah, that's what I do. I just made up this sports thing. And he said, well, I'm thinking about making you one of my main news anchors, but do you have any reporting experience? I said, well, that's all I was ever allowed to do. I was never allowed near an anchor desk. That's really what I am. He's like, okay. So he made me a news anchor, and that's how I ended up being a news anchor at CNN. And that's where I was for the last 8 to 9 years before I left in the end of 2006.
Interesting.
So it's full circle.
Yeah, interesting. And it didn't come easy, but you did not give up. And, you know, it's very admirable when people go through, you know, they have a dream and they pursue it no matter what. Now, I have to ask you, since the first news director said, you know, men don't watch women doing sports.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's actually fairly common today, but back then it was much less common. How did men relate to you doing the sports reviews?
You know, it was interesting in a couple of ways. One, I mean, I certainly do not claim to be a groundbreaker in that department. I mean, there's certainly a lot more women doing it now than when I was doing it, but you know, women like Leslie Visser and Robin Roberts, they definitely were coming up before me. So I would say I was kind of like that next wave. So it wasn't like, whoa, what's a woman doing here? But it was also interesting in that it was very much a man's world, and there's only so much you can do in that world. I mean, you're never going to rise probably to be the play-by-play. I mean, the Yankees have a play-by-play woman. I mean, so it's not to say there aren't some women doing it, but there's only so far I was going to go with that. And the other thing I realized when I was doing sports, that if the male sportscaster messed up a name, some athlete's name, it would be, oh, they tripped over a name. If I tripped over a name, it would be, oh, look, she doesn't know sports.
Mm.
But to me, I don't say that as a gripe. I say that as that's that reality, and mm-hmm. that's the standard you're expected to be at. And if you don't want to play, then don't play.
Right.
It just meant you had to be really, really good and really know your stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're with CNN, I mean, I saw photographs of you on the red carpet at the Oscars. I saw
mm-hmm.
photographs of you out in Kuwait City when the Iraqi war started. What kind of stories did you cover? Obviously, you ran the gamut, but, you know, what were your favorite kind of stories to cover?
Right. Well, my main gig was to be a news anchor, and I was the by East Coast time, the late morning news anchor. So I would be on from like 9 to noon Eastern. And so my main job was to be there every day and to anchor the news, and it was kind of like having the front row seat of the roller coaster. And I love that part. I love, you know, like, okay, here we go. What's happening in the world? And it's my job to tell you what's going on. I kind of equate it to being an emergency room doctor. You have a certain set of skills, and you show up for work every day, and it's a really intense shift, and you have no idea what's going to roll through the door.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, bring it on. That was very, very challenging and really, really fun.
Yeah.
So that meant, you know, being on air for a 9/11 when the second plane hit the World Trade Center, any number of other breaking news stories. You show up and you have no idea what it's going to be, and I really enjoyed that. Meanwhile, it being CNN, I had a chance to travel the world and do all types of stories. So, as you mentioned, I was in the war. I was in Kuwait for the start of the war. I covered the Oscars a number of times. I traveled Africa with Bono in 2002.
That was fun.
That was, you know, you're talking about the sacrifices of this business. Somebody had to go. So that was one of the huge personal sacrifices I made, to travel with Bono for 2 weeks through Africa. Yeah, that was a tremendous, tremendous trip. That was very good.
Yeah, fun. And I would imagine that adrenaline rush gets very addictive when you're when you're in the hot seat like that day after day.
Yeah, I mean, I think you either like it or you don't. Mm-hmm. Some people think that that's nuts, like that would be too nerve-wracking. To me, yeah, I loved it. I loved that part of it. I had a very, very good job.
All right, well, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Darren Kagan. She's the author of What's Possible? 50 True Stories of People Who Dared to Dream. They could make a difference. And we'll find out how Darren is making a difference in her work now. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Thanks to its listeners, Alternative Talk 1150 has become the most refreshing talk radio in our area. We want to hear more. Log on to 1150kknw.com and take a brief survey. Besides helping improve your favorite station, you'll have a chance to win 2 nights in a family suite at the brand new Great Wolf Lodge, located south of Olympia. Voice your opinion and have a chance to win. Log on now to 1150kknw.com. Contest details and rules posted online.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show at its new time, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Bringing you fresh perspectives every day. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my special guest today is Darren Kagan. She's a former anchor from CNN who forged a whole new life for herself when she left CNN and is now helping make a difference and meeting a lot of people who are also making a difference in other people's lives. And we'll be sharing some of those stories with you throughout the rest of today's show. So, Darren, we've got to the point where you're anchoring for CNN, you're having all these great stories. When did you find out that they were not going to renew your contract? How did that come about?
That was the beginning of 2006. I had been at CNN 12 years, and the big boss called me in. I thought I was being called in because he was going to tell me what a great job I did on breaking news that day. There was a new tape out from Osama bin Laden, and I'd done a good job, and so I thought I was just getting called in to get a pat on the back. And instead, they did the close the door thing and said, well, we know your contract's up at the end of the year, and we want you to know right now we're not going to continue your contract. And just so for people understand, in TV news, usually you have like a 2 to 3 year contract, and it goes in cycles. And at the end of every time, they can decide, well, do you still work here or don't you? And so here they were giving me a year's notice that I would not be working at with CNN at the end of the year. An unusual thing, though, in this case, usually what that happens if you're on air, they show you the door. I mean, if they know somebody knows that they're going to be fired, they don't want you to lie on live television. Instead, I guess with me, there had been such a sense of trust that had built up over the years. He said, well, you know, you have a year, and I'd actually like you to stay, and I have no intention to take you off the air. Well, I don't think I do. I'll let you know. So as I left his office, I didn't know then what was going to be my last day. Every day I came to work.
A lot of uncertainty there.
Yeah, every day I came to work, I didn't know, oh, it was just my last day at the place that I worked 12 years. Mm-hmm. So that was a little unsettling. It also, though, ended up being a gift because I certainly did not go pirouetting out of the boss's office knowing exactly what I was going to go do with my life.
Right.
So there was a gift of time in that it gave me some time to be sad for a few months. It gave me the time to eliminate that I didn't want to go do another traditional news job. And then ultimately gave me the time to think of this kind of wacky, incredible idea I came up with of what to do with my life.
Yeah. Now, before we get into that, I have to ask you, because you spent all these years as a journalist asking mm-hmm. key questions, and yet you say in the book you chose mm-hmm. not to ask why they weren't renewing your contract.
Yeah, so there I am in the boss's office, and he kind of gives me like kind of the biggest news of my life, one of them. You know, we won't be, and I really chose not to ask why. And I would say for two reasons. Maybe for three. Ultimately, if they don't want you, they don't want you. What does it really matter? Two, what's he going to say? You know, in this era of lawsuits, whatever reason they were picking. I mean, I knew I was really good at my job.
Mm.
So whatever reason they were picking for not keeping me on, I really didn't know that I was going to get a straight answer. And ultimately, as I was sitting there in the boss's office, I really heard this inner voice say, Darren, it's time. And I didn't know time for what, and I certainly didn't want it to be time, but indeed it was time. And so I knew it was like that the next chapter was here.
It was a gentle hand helping you along the way there.
Exactly. Or like a kick in the rear, depending on what body part we're thinking about in a particular day.
But you do say later on in the book that, you know, those times when the bummer situations, as you called them, mm-hmm. often come as blessings in disguise, and this certainly worked out very well for you. So you had to go through this year of still being on the air, not knowing when your last day was going.
Yes.
I read that you lost your passion. You said you'd lost your passion for going through the process again and, you know, trying to get a new job as a hard news anchor.
Yeah, I mean, the only way, the closest thing I can think I can equate it to is like when professional athletes know it's time to retire. You just know you're done. It's not like you regret anything you did or that it wasn't a wonderful ride. But, you know, it was a couple things. One, I didn't want to, I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I didn't necessarily want to pick up and move to New York or, you know, just to get another TV news job. I also could see, and I really don't see how I had this clear vision, but it really has turned out this way. I could see the business was changing, and that even if I did go get that next job, which, you know, maybe I would have gone to MSNBC or Fox or local news, probably within 3 to 4 years, I'd be right back where I am, mm-hmm. and that would be out on the street. Technology is changing the kind of people that they hire, the kind of money they spend. Age, again, you know, are you going to hire somebody at the time it would have been mid-40s, or are you going to hire a 20-something who you can hire at a quarter of the salary? And again, I don't say that from a bitter standpoint. It's changing, and we don't live in France, and you're not guaranteed lifetime employment, and I could just see going forward it wasn't going to be a fit. So at some point, I was going to have to reinvent myself, and I was lucky enough to have the idea at this time. So, you know, why not now? No time like the present.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to face reality because so many people do go into that denial phase when they're going through a situation that they don't have a lot of control over, but they ultimately have to face. And so I think, you know, facing that head on for you probably gave you the extra push to move forward.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people, when they see what I've done, they say, oh, you were so brave, you must have been afraid to go in that direction. It's like, no, I would have been afraid to go get a job in traditional news. That would have been scary because I would have always been looking over my shoulder of, you know, here comes the axe.
Right.
So I went with what I thought was the surest thing, and that was creating my own media company.
Yeah, so let's talk about how you got the spark for that idea. I read the spark came to you when you were looking, I think it was at a website for for war coverage.
Yes.
And you get this idea, which is totally the opposite.
Right. So ultimately what I did, I created DarrenKagan.com. It's the web's one-stop destination for inspiring news. Every story fits the theme, show the world what's possible. The thing I know now that I wish I knew at the beginning is that inspiration comes in pieces. You know, we all want to open the front door and see a nice little package of our future, like it came from the Bloomingdale's catalog.
Right.
Oh, there it is.
That would be good.
but really, it's much more of a little treasure hunt where you're looking for things that spark your interest and make you go, and think, you know, get you excited about things. And so it comes in little pieces, and it can come from the most surprising places. And that's why you always have to have your eyes open. And you're absolutely right. My first spark of inspiration came in 2006. Yahoo had this page that was called The War Zone with Kevin Seitz. And Kevin had been a war correspondent for CNN and NBC, and they hired him basically to go to every war zone and report from there. So it said, you went to this website and it said, one man, one year, one purpose, go to every bad place in the world, basically.
And wow.
Went from war zone to war zone. And I looked at that and my jaw just dropped and I thought, you can have one of those. You can have a website where you just do your favorite kind of reporting. You know, our world's changing so fast, and that's not that long ago, and now it kind of seems like a no-brainer. But, yeah, in the beginning of 2006 or mid-2006, that's kind of a new concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, as a little creative exercise, just thought, well, what would mine be? And as we talked about, I got to do everything with CNN, but my favorite stories were always these inspirational stories, the ones that made your heart go zing. And I thought, well, why not one woman, one year, one idea, go to every inspiring place in the world? And that's how the first idea for ultimately what became my new business came to me, as I'm looking at this website based on war.
That's awesome how things piece together like that. But I also read that you almost gave this idea away. You went to Yahoo to try and, what, sell the idea to them? Or?
Yeah, don't try this at home. That's my takeaway for you today. Don't come up with your really good idea and then try to give it away to another company. No. You're right. I talked my way into Yahoo, you know, through some connections, and I honestly thought this was the world's easiest business pitch ever. So I'll try it on you. You go to Yahoo, and you can get your news, your sports, your stocks, your war. Where's a Yahoo in Yahoo? I thought you should be able to click on that logo and get a great feeling about the world and, you know, and about life.
Right.
And so I made that pitch, and they didn't get it.
But that's awesome.
That's
great
awesome.
That they
it
didn't get
very
it.
Very awesome. Exactly. Yeah. That would have been not such a good thing if they got it. It would have made like 5 cents. And so ultimately my number one business advisor, this is the most painful part of my story because I have to admit that the one with the great ideas was my little sister, which anybody who has a little sister knows that that's not easy to do. But indeed, it was the little sister who looked at me and said, what are you doing? You know, why are you giving this away? Go make your own website. That'll be your home. You'll brand yourself as this inspirational storyteller. You'll have the website. You'll do books, you'll do documentaries, you do television. I mean, she kind of painted the whole picture. And you know, even with that, I still didn't really kind of. That's not what I was excited about. I never had been one of those people who was dying to have my own company. It wasn't even necessarily what I was excited about doing. But ultimately, the reason I did get excited is because I have this thing about getting picked. You know, we all have to get picked. And
right.
In the news business, you've got to get picked to get hired. You got to get picked for the job. You got to get picked for the story. It's a lot of heartbreak when you don't get picked. And I thought, you know, if I do this direction, I get to pick me. And that really, really felt good.
Mm.
And that's the simple reason why I headed down that road of creating it for myself.
Well, a couple of great lessons there, too, you know, opening up to other people. Actually, my sister was integral in my big move, too.
This is true confessions of sisters.
And she's my little sister, yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. So you understand my pain.
But she said to me, I was talking with her one day, and I was telling her all the reasons I could not do this because, you know, I'm self-supporting, and I've got to do this, and I've got to do that. But I wanted to move to a whole new state, and I wanted to create this whole new life. And she sat there and listened to me, and she goes, and I'd estimated it was going to cost about $20,000. She goes, and you're telling me you're not worth $20,000?
Uh-huh.
And then she reamed me a new one.
Okay, as only a little sister can do.
Yeah, but that's good, you know, opening up. And then, of course, you've gone through this rejection again. So tell us how you cope with rejection, because you just push through it, obviously.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have to say that since I started down this path of creating this inspirational media company, it's kind of been the opposite. It's like more like everyone and everything I've needed has just kind of shown up. Mm. So instead of this 20-year journey of please, please, please pick me, it's more kind of like the universe is picking me. And, yeah, everyone and everything I've needed has just shown up. I haven't had to go trying to convince anybody of anything.
Yeah, I think one of the key points that highlighted that, that you were on the right path. I mean, one of the situations was you couldn't even register your own name, DarrenKagan.com, because somebody else had already bought that name, that URL.
Yeah, so the first, anybody who's even started a blog or anything, you know the first thing you do is you want to go register your domain name. And it's really easy. You go, there's any number of websites where you can do it. But I went to a place called GoDaddy.com, which is one of the big ones. And it's simple. You type in the name you want, and you click buy, and it costs like $8.95. No big deal. So I was still at CNN. This was that time when, you know, they hadn't pulled me off the air. They hadn't kicked me out the door yet. I hadn't really told anybody what I wanted to do. But I had decided that I would call my website by my name because I had the national profile from having been on the air for 12 years. And I thought, oh, this is simple. So I went and I typed in DarrenKagan.com. Click buy, and the screen comes back, and it says taken. I'm like, taken?
But that's my name.
Now, I don't know a lot, but I know there are not a lot of Darren Kagans running around. And I'd like to share this story because, one, it shows how well things can go, but also it really shows how beyond little I knew about this world that I was going into. I honestly thought I just had to pick up the phone and call the company and just have a little discussion and just explain to them that man down in Boca Raton, Florida, was not Darren Kagan, and that they would do a few clicks and give me back my name. Instead, when I called, they explained, they said, lady, you got a problem. It's called cyber squatting, and people do it all the time. They pull down and buy names that they think people are going to want. They told me, expect to pay tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars to get your own name back or hire a really expensive lawyer. And so I hung up thinking, well, this is not the way I wanted to start my journey of creating inspirational news.
Right.
This is not the chapter I was writing. But I thought, well, let's test this out. Let's just see, you know, what kind of karma this project has. So I had the man's email, and I literally wrote him this email. I said, Dear Mr. Boone, thank you for thinking of me when you went to register domain names, but now I think the time has come for DarrenKagan.com to go back to its rightful owner, which, of course, would be me. And I talked to the company, you know, three clicks, and we can transfer ownership. I didn't mention money. I didn't mention lawyers, and I didn't even tell him what I wanted to do with it. He called me the next day, and we're having a little chat, and he was an artist down in Boca. And as we're talking, he's sending me pictures of his art, which I am assuring him, by the way, is very beautiful art. I love those palm trees. Excellent. And anyhow, we're chatting, and he just said, well, why do you think I have your name? And I said, I don't know. And he says, don't get me wrong. I watch you on CNN. I'm a big fan. But why do you think out of everybody in the world I have your name? And this is usually at CNN what you call the security department because they're like some kind of like a stalker situation.
Right.
And I said, you know, I honestly don't know. And he just got really, really quiet. And he just said, you know, I think I know. I think I was meant to have it and hold on to it so nobody else would take advantage of you.
Amazing.
I was like, really? Well, can I have it back? He said, yeah. And that night, three clicks. He gave me my name back, and that's how I got ownership of DarrenKagan.com. Not a dime changed hands, no money, no lawyers. And he isn't even one of those weird stalkers. I've only heard from him like maybe two times since that conversation, and only for him to say, you know, good for you. Look what you're doing with DarrenKagan.com.
Yeah. And I guess this was important for you in more ways than one because it also made you feel that, hey, I am on the right path because doors are opening, but you know, before I'm even really asking them to.
Oh, exactly. And that was just the first of many, many, many different situations. It almost becomes like a giggle fest, like, wow, who's going to show up now or what else is going to go right? You just start expecting things to go right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's take a break. And when we come back, I'd like to look at exactly what you've created here and some of the stories, because they truly are amazing. The thing that I liked about the stories you share in your book are some of the stories, you know, in anthologies out there are a bit schmaltzy for me. These were really great stories that truly inspiring. So my guest today is Darren Kagan. Her website is darrenkagan.com. Her book is called What's Possible? 50 True Stories of People Who Dared to Dream They Could Make a Difference. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Coming July 14th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, The Scalpel and the Soul. Neurosurgeon Dr. Alan Hamilton joins Vicky to share his real-life encounters with surgery, the supernatural, and the healing power of hope. His experiences and insights push the limits of present scientific knowledge and will inspire everyone, from ordinary citizens to medical professionals, to look beyond what we think we know. That's coming July 14th at noon, here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. And be sure and tune in every Monday at noon for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Hi, this is Howard Bono, the host of The Money Thing, heard right here on Tuesdays at noon. You don't need to know everything about money, but there are some things you really should know. Each week, my co-host Gary Mance and I will bring you the information that you need. We cut through all the verbiage and marketing hype to provide you with an hour of condensed, easy to understand information. We want to improve the quality of your life by taking the financial stress away. So join us for The Money Thing, Tuesdays at noon, here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Listen live at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Darren Kagan. She is a former news anchor with CNN. She was there from 1994 to 2006. And she left the network after 12 years to reinvent her career and take that experience, her 20-plus years of television experience in hard news, to tell the stories that she always loved to tell, inspirational stories. And we're going to hear about some of those in this segment. So, Darren, I want to give out your website to everybody, and we'll do it again one more time before the end of the show, because we spell Darren D-A-R-Y-N, and then Kagan is K-A-G-A-N, so it's darrenkagan.com. And you'll find some of Darren's amazing stories and some video up there. So you've left CNN. You've got this great idea. Where do you go from there, Darren?
Yeah, well, so I ended up leaving CNN September 1st, 2006. So that's, I guess, 9 months after they told me I would be leaving. And 6 weeks later, I launched the website, which, by the way, the easy way to find it, you just have to remember Darren, D-A-R-Y-N. If you Google that, it'll take you right to the website. It
okay,
now
great.
Is the number one ranking under Darren. So, yeah, so that was the first thing. And then I've done a couple documentaries. And then my first book came out this spring, What's Possible, that you mentioned.
So where did you get the idea for the stories? I mean, how did you start gathering these? And
My big fancy plan was like the movie Field of Dreams, build it and they will come.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people in traditional media tried to tell me, oh, you won't possibly have enough content. You know, there's not enough good in the world, you know, that you can talk about.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, well, if I create a vessel for these stories to exist, then they'll come to me. And that really, truly is what has happened, both by just being able to find them. And then every page of my website has a box that says, tell me your story. Because I found people just don't want to experience inspirational content. Many people have a story to tell, and they want to be able to participate as well. But I didn't want it to be a blog or like YouTube where anybody could put anything up, because I wanted to guarantee the experience you get when you come, that this has been a vetted website with stories that are true and good and that have a journalistic bent to them. Mm. So when you click on that box, a form generates, and you can write in your story. And that's been just wonderful because I would say like between 60 to 70% of the content on my site comes just from that box.
Oh, amazing.
So yeah. Not only do people get a chance to participate, they're doing my work for me. It's like it's like having a worldwide assignment desk. You know, there's people out there just looking for content for me.
Mm. So I read that you do your own filming. You went from Anchorwoman to doing your own filming and having to learn how to use the camera. Are you still doing your own filming or...?
Yeah, I do a combination. I do use a photographer when I'm taping, you know, what you see on the website, the introductions. We tape the whole week, a week's worth at once. But I often do go out and shoot my own stories by myself, which you're right, is a very different experience than being the fancy CNN anchorwoman showing up with the crew to do all that technical work for me.
Mm.
But it's freed me up to, you know, if I see a story that I want to go do, you know, I get on a plane and go do it and don't have to hire a big crew to go do it.
Yeah, sounds good. So then where did the idea for the book come?
That also just kind of showed up. the whole idea of the company, you know, it's not just the website. It's about owning content. And so creating content and putting on as many platforms as possible. So I got the website up and going and then was contacted by a book agent who said this should be a book. And we made a proposal and sent it around, and Meredith Books, the folks, that's a division, the folks who own Ladies Home Journal, More Magazine, Better Homes and Gardens, they came to me and we made a book.
Right, right. And the book has 50, it has your journey in there.
Right. I'm the first story.
Well, it is very inspiring. Then it has 50 inspiring stories in there of people who've defied the odds, survived incredible hardships, and just had big dreams. And when I say big dreams, the one that springs to mind instantly is the fellow who, when he was a little boy, wanted to tie balloons to his lawn chair and float off into the sky.
That's actually a Northwest story. That's Kent Couch, and he's in Oregon. Yeah, he had this childhood dream of not just that he wanted to fly in the clouds. And he grew up, I think he's in Bend, Oregon, a convenience store owner, and just never let go of that dream, and researched with a buddy how he could do this and make it happen, and has come up with an idea to take these huge helium balloons and attach it to a lawn chair and fly. And he's actually had a couple flights, and I just got an email from his marketing person. They're going to go again on July 5th.
Right, and this is another one of yours, do not do these at home.
Yeah, don't necessarily try that, but the reason I would include that is, you know, that the obstacle he overcame was holding on to a childhood dream and not letting somebody tell him it was silly and foolish.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I don't necessarily think we all need to go tie helium balloons to our lawn chairs and float off into the distance, but I would love to inspire and encourage people, you know, what is that thing that you dreamed of when you were a kid? That you could go off and do, and that you still have, you know, that hasn't left your heart and your mind.
Mm.
What's your lawn chair idea? Here is somebody who, you know, didn't have huge financial resources or necessarily great support, but went off and did it. The ultimate idea of the book is, yes, to enjoy and live for these people's dreams, but I really want to inspire the readers what's possible dreams of their own.
Right. Do you have a favorite story, Darren?
Oh, that's really hard. It's like picking your favorite child. you know, for me, it was important to include all different types of obstacles. So there's some really big ones. Like you mentioned when the break, you were telling me you had Kelly Perkins on. Well, Kelly's in my book. Kelly is a heart transplant recipient who is also a mountain climber and climbs the tallest mountains in the world to promote organ donation. Well, I love her story and love Kelly. But really, how many people are going to have a heart transplant or even go climb a mountain?
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted dreams and obstacles that were also more real. So you also read about Sharon Hayes Brown, who is a mom in North Carolina. It took her 21 years to get her undergraduate college degree. And the reason it took her so long, and it certainly wasn't the path that she had planned, was she, at the same time that she was getting her college degree, she and her husband were building their family with a combination of biological and adopted children. So just as she built her family one child at a time, she built her college career and her college curriculum one course at a time. And yeah, it took a long time to build both, but ultimately she achieved both dreams.
Amazing. One of my favorite stories was about the little Chinese girl who was given away by her parents to her aunt and uncle. And then when she was 11, her aunt got pregnant, and so she was given back to her parents. But she grew up, you know, in what conditions that we'd consider child labor today. And would you take away the rest of the story and her
Marilyn
success?
Marilyn Tam, as you mentioned, grew up, and she did work in one of those child labor type of factories in China as she was growing up. Turns out she ended up coming to America and was educated and working for some of the biggest corporations, including Nike and Reebok, and it became her passion. As she got into a position of big power, she then reformed the ways a lot of those companies were doing business and producing their products. So she was able to make a to go back and then make a difference so that their children weren't experiencing the same type of conditions that she was as she was a little girl.
And one thing that a couple of things I took away from that story, she was not at all bitter. She just had the philosophy, life is what it is, and then, of course, what you make of it. And also, that just flew out of my head, the other key thing there with her. But she was not bitter at all in any way, shape, or form. And, okay, the other thing that I wanted to mention was that she now stays at companies long enough to make a difference. And as soon as she's made the difference she wants to make, she then moves on to another company and tries to make a difference there, too.
Yeah, now, ultimately, I think Marilyn's out there as a consultant. So she's got her hands in a lot of in a lot of pies. But I think what you bring up about her not being bitter is really, really key. And that, you know, when you see all the different types of obstacles that people in the book go through, it would be so easy to get stuck. And this is not to say that we all don't feel the feel, that when that bad thing happens to you, that you don't grieve, that you don't have your hard times. But ultimately, there will come the day that you wake up and it's kind of the now what day. And so now what are you going to do? And that's where the choice comes in. I really don't think it's smart to skip the step where you feel and you have the hard time. But after that, the choice you have, you might not have chosen that thing that happened to you. I mean, I have breast cancer survivors in the book, and I have people who have had financial difficulties, and you know, people who have lost children. I mean, terrible things that you would think you would never pick for yourself. But the thing you get to pick is, what are you going to do with that experience? And that's where the ultimate power comes in. And that's what I think makes the people in the book different than from so many people who just get stuck and bitter in the thing that they think happened to them.
Yeah, another key thing you said when you were interviewing and talking with these people that you met with for the book, that it was very hard to get them to talk about the challenges because many of them just did not see the challenges. They were so focused on what they wanted to do.
Yeah, that was interesting. You know, of course, if you're writing the book, you're trying to pass on to other people who have challenges. So how hard was this? Or how? Some of them just don't see it. they're just so happy in what they're doing. It's like, okay, come back around. One of my favorite people that I've been so blessed to get to know through this journey is a man named Bill Montgomery. Bill is 91 years old, and he's a blind sculptor. And Bill only learned how to sculpt when he was 80 years old and lost his sight. And it's hard to convey over the radio how good of a sculptor Bill is. We're not talking like cute little art therapy class. I mean, we're talking beautiful bronze sculptures that sell for thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah, you have a video of him on your website.
I do. And Bill, you know, talk about being bitter, 80 years old and losing your sight. That's a great time to give up, you'd think. And Bill sees it as, life took one thing away and gave him something else. And he has this beautiful description of how he now sees with his fingers. And he can't wait to get out of bed every day because there's so much to do and so many people to meet and so many things to go do and art to create. And, that day that I spent with him, well, I've been with him a few times, but the first day where I shot the video for the website, it was actually kind of frustrating because it was like, okay, Bill, now let's talk about the hard stuff. Oh, let me tell you how great this thing is. Bill, focus for me, you know? But it's really true. What I end up finding then is the things that you focus on, the things that grow. So because Bill Montgomery focuses on the possibility and the excitement, that's what's big and grows in his life. Because Cameron Johnson, who was a teenager who made his first million, didn't see that it was a problem to be a teenager in the business world, He just saw all the opportunities. That's what grew in his life. And it really is a good lesson in that what you focus on is what grows in your life. You focus on the hard things, the challenges, that's what you're going to get stuck on. And you focus on the possibility, and that's what shows up.
Definitely. And that 15-year-old boy who became a millionaire at the age of 15 that you just mentioned, Cameron, he actually wrote his first business letter when he was 8, I was reading. So he just
saw
no obstacles.
And actually, he just was on Oprah's Big Give. He was one of the final, he like was one of the last two or three people.
Oh, really?
But I had him first. My book came out before Oprah's Big Give. So she saw similar talent in him.
You have at the end of most of the stories, you have Darren's giveaway, takeaway, excuse mm-hmm. me, Darren's takeaway, what you took away from that. What was the biggest takeaway for you when you were talking with these folks?
Yeah, it was important to me to not just put a bunch of inspiring stories there. I wanted to add my voice and to talk about why each person inspired me and then also help the reader see how that particular story might not apply to your own life, but again, how you could get some things out of that that will help you go for your what's possible. I would say, well, one that you mentioned is that your big bummer could be your big chance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing you would have never picked it might be your chance to go do what you want to go do. I know in my own case, if CNN hadn't kicked me out the door, I'd be sitting in the anchor chair, which was good and it wouldn't be bad, but I wouldn't be doing what right now is my life purpose.
Right.
Also, I learned through a lot of these people who have gone through hard times that a lot, healing can come through service, that if you can't quite get out of your own way and your own sadness and your own grief, go do something that helps somebody else.
I think that is a huge lesson.
I think
when people learn that lesson, it made a significant difference in my life when I learned that lesson.
Did it?
Yeah, it changes the way you look at yourself because it takes you out of yourself, for one thing.
It's almost like popping an aspirin in a way because it's kind of like a law of physics of you can't be focused on helping somebody else and focused on your own stuff at the same time. It's like saying drive in two completely different directions. You just can't. So even if it's just for the amount of time that you're working on that thing for somebody else, it takes you out of that place. So that's its gift. Then when you see what you get in helping somebody else, wow, I mean, that's its own high unto itself. And so, you know, it's really kind of a quick fix.
Right.
And that's a wonderful thing. Another thing that I learned in talking to these people is how you handle critics. Because anybody who's going to go for a dream is going to be told that that's a really dumb idea. sometimes that people, it could be your spouse, it could be your family, it could be people who you respect in your business. You're going to have people who aren't that supportive. And so what do you do? Or people maybe even who are just jealous. What do you do with that? And what I've come to realize is what I call my energy budget. That, you know, when you wake up every day, people are very familiar with their financial budget. You know how much you can spend on your rent, your mortgage, your car, your vacation. If you can afford a day at the beach, you're not going to go buy a yacht. You know that that wouldn't be a good way to spend your money because you don't have that. Well, we also all have an energy budget. You have so much energy, so many units of energy you get to spend every day. And the power comes and you get to choose how to spend it. Personally, I don't spend it on my critics.
Excellent.
I just don't think that's a good investment of time. It's almost like throwing money out the window.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I don't listen and I haven't learned and there's not constructive criticism, but somebody who's just looking to tear me down for the sake of it, I don't really have time for
you. Put your energy elsewhere. Well,
yeah.
Darren Kagan, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. And you've got me all revved up.
Oh, good.
So we want to go ahead and give out your website again.
Okay.
It's darrenkagan.com. And remember, the Darren is DarynKagan. And Darren's book is What's Possible? 50 True Stories of People Who Dared to Dream They Could Make a Difference. Well, I think you're making a difference with your work, Darren. I did it again, see? Darren, so thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. And say hi to your sister, Karen.
I will.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks. Yeah, I was telling Darren my sister has the same initials but flip-flopped. That's why I keep getting the names muddled up today. But I want to thank you for being with us today. Please remember to log on to KKNW's survey and take the survey. You can enter the contest to win to two nights at the brand new Great Wolf Lodge down south of Olympia. And you can do that at 1150kknw.com. That's 1150kknw.com. And you can check out more information at conversationslive.net. We have the Kelly Perkins podcast on there that we talked about earlier today. She was one of the guests in Darren's book. So thanks for being with us. Please join me next Monday at noon for more Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Meanwhile, live well, live strong.
Thanks to its listeners, Alternative Talk 1150 has become the most refreshing talk radio in our area. We want to hear more. Log on to 1150kknw.com and take a brief survey. Besides helping improve your favorite station, you'll have...